On February 3rd, Senegal's president Macky Sall announced that he was unilaterally and indefinitely postponing the country's presidential elections, which had been scheduled for February 25th. 2 days later, 105 out of the Senegalese legislature's 165 members voted to set December 15th as the new election date. Some opposition members of parliament attempted to physically block that vote from occurring, and three were arrested on February 6th. On February 15th, Senegal's constitutional court ruled that elections must take place before Sall's term expires on April 2nd. In a February 22nd press conference, Sall promised that he would leave office by that date and pledged to hold a national dialogue to determine the new election date. The dialogue panel ultimately proposed June 2nd. Then, in a second ruling on March 6th, the court rejected the June 2nd date and again insisted that the vote must take place before Sall's term ends. That same day, Sall set March 24th as the election date. The March 24th scheduling, which the court subsequently upheld, seems to have ended the election saga, although further disruptions are certainly possible. The result has been one of the most fraught periods in recent West African politics, with concerns emanating far beyond Senegal itself. The crisis has received intensive attention, not just because Senegal is considered relatively stable, but also because of a wider context that has seen four West African civilian presidents fall to coups since 2020. The blows to democracy, or if democracy is too strong a word, let's say the blows to civilian-led multi-party systems, have flummoxed American and European diplomats, as well as African regional organizations such as the African Union, the AU, and the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. There will be many sighs of relief when and if Sall moves on, and the Constitutional Court's show of judicial independence suggests that institutions do have weight in Senegal alongside personalities. Yet the episode shows how vulnerable almost any country is to what we might call the politics of ambiguity, a theme I'll return to below. The story also highlights how the presidency has become an object of obsession in West Africa and around the world. The intensive effort to obtain and hold presidencies threatens to crowd out serious policymaking, as well as other forms of politics. The state, and the position that controls at least some of its levers, is so powerful that many officeholders will do whatever they can get away with to stay there. Contests over presidencies come to monopolize a considerable portion of the public's attention and energies, from Dakar to DC. The next section is called A Brief History of Senegal's Political System. Senegal has the distinction, unique in West Africa, of having been coup-free throughout its post-independence history since 1960. Yet that does not mean there has been no autocracy in the country. As Rama Jang writes, all incumbent presidents have attempted to remain in power through manipulating electoral laws. President Leopold Senghor ruled from 1960 to 1980, and his handpicked successor Abdou Diouf ruled from 1981 until 2000. Senghor jailed and suppressed various opponents and ran unopposed in the presidential elections of 1963 and 1968. Even the semi-competitive elections in 1978, 1983, 1988, and 1993 saw the incumbent, meaning Senghor in 1978 and Diouf the next three times, take decisive majorities, including scores of more than 80% for Senghor in 1978 and for Diouf in 1983. Tellingly, and in what appears to be more a sign of authoritarian nervousness than of the actual popular will, Diouf's vote share fell steadily from 1983 through 2000, when he lost decisively in the second round. The long road to Senegal's alternance in 2000 did not necessarily produce a thriving democracy. The chief opposition candidate from 1978 to 2000, the lawyer and economist Abdoulaye Wade, partly reproduced a pseudo-authoritarian style when he finally became president in 2000. In a trend that continued under Sall, Wade appeared keen to tinker with the political system to his own advantage, notably by changing the length of presidential terms from 7 years to 5 years and then back, changes that eventually facilitated a shaky legal argument on Wade's part that he was eligible for a third term, despite constitutional limits. Wade was ultimately defeated at the ballot box in the second round of the 2012 election, a defeat that could be read as a win for the streets. Mass protests and mobilization were key factors in pressuring Wade to concede defeat, but also as a blow to procedure and the integrity of the system. If street pressure in combination with elite mobilization and international pressure can force out a stubborn incumbent, it suggests that the system is highly vulnerable to presidents who want to test how much strain it can bear. Sall has understood this, I think. As the beneficiary of Wade's fall, just as with Wade versus Diouf in 2000, the opposition rallied around Sall in the second round of the 2012 election. Sall nevertheless again proved more a power-maximizing manipulator of the system than a committed Democrat. Particularly egregious were two issues, one of which saw Saul replicating some of Wad's techniques, and the other of which saw Saul go even further. First, then, Saul continued Wad's practice of tinkering with the system, especially on the issue of presidential term lengths. While serving his first 7-year term from 2012 to 2019, Saul shepherded through a referendum that, among other provisions, changed term lengths back to 5 years. Saul later flirted with making a similar argument to Wad's from 2012, namely that the varied term lengths somehow meant that his first term did not count toward the 2-term limit. Unlike Wad, Saul eventually backed down, under domestic and international pressure, from seeking a 3rd term, announcing in July 2023 that he would not do so. Second, and to a greater level than during Wad's presidency, the Senegalese judiciary appeared to become a servant of Saul's political interests. 3 prominent cases targeted, in turn, Saul's greatest rival at any given moment. First, Wad's son Karim, then the capital's mayor Khalifa Saul, no relation to the president, and finally, the tax inspector turned firebrand Ousmane Sonko. The accusations varied from corruption, for Karim Wad and Khalifa Saul, to rape, for Sonko. It has been difficult to assess the credibility of each charge, given how politically convenient they have proven for Macky Sall. In 2019, Karim Wad and Khalifa Saul's respective court cases blocked the two from contesting that year's elections, which Saul won in the first round with 58%, thus avoiding the scenario that had occurred in 2000 and 2012, when the opposition had rallied around a single candidate in the second round and had thereby unseated the incumbent. In the lead-up to 2024, it has been Sonko's turn to see his candidacy denied. The court cases, which ended with pardons for Karim Wad and Khalifa Saul, have functioned not just to block candidacies, but also to keep key figures in legal limbo during critical periods. If Macky Sall had all these levers to use to control the system, how did we get here? Initially, it had seemed that when Plan A, a 3rd term, didn't work out, then Sall would be comfortable with Plan B, designating a successor, namely Prime Minister Amadou Ba. Through February 3rd, I had expected that this year's election would be a coronation for Ba, especially with Sonko denied a place on the ballot. I can only speculate as to what prompted Saul's attempted postponement of the election, but one thing on his mind may be that such arrangements, wherein the departing president picks a loyalist successor, have not gone smoothly in West Africa of late. In Senegal's neighbor Mauritania in 2019, departing president Mohamed Wald Abdelaziz handed power to his longtime associate Mohamed Wald Ghazouani. The two men had served together for 4 decades at that point, orchestrating 2 coups together in 2005 and 2008, and seeming to jointly incarnate the country's military-dominated politics. None of that stopped the two men from almost immediately falling out after Wald Ghazouani took office. Within months, Wald Abdelaziz had lost control of the ruling party and was facing a parliamentary investigation over corruption allegations. Last summer, he received a 5-year prison sentence. Further afield, in Niger, President Mahamadou Issoufou, who was in office from 2011 to 2021, seemed similarly close to his longtime fellow party member and top advisor Mohamed Bazoum, who succeeded him. Yet when a coup struck Niger in July 2023, rumors flew that Issoufou was implicated. Saul may calculate, and reasonably so, that once Ba takes the oath of office, he will no longer be under Saul's thumb. Perhaps the past several weeks have simply been Saul's attempt to buy time to rethink his succession plans. Now it seems Saul may have considered a return to Plan A, though the precedent of Issoufou suggests that Saul's involvement in Senegalese politics will not end even after he leaves office. Perhaps Saul also pushed the courts too far. It is one thing for courts to wittingly or unwittingly aid the incumbent in tipping and manipulating the playing field during the course of scheduled elections. It is another for the incumbent to throw the entire system into question. Saul may have miscalculated about exactly how compliant the country's institutions were. The legislature fell into line, but not the judiciary. The next section is called The Politics of Ambiguity. Saul, during this episode, leaned on a politics of ambiguity. He allowed years of speculation about his possible 3rd-term intentions, and the current cycle of postponements and adjustments to the electoral calendar has involved considerable uncertainty. Politicians have a lot to gain by cultivating and perpetuating uncertainty around their intentions. Not only does it keep opponents and popular protesters off balance, it also subtly reinforces the corrosive idea that nothing is sacrosanct. If an election can be delayed to December or even June, then perhaps it could be delayed again and again. Many other leaders in the region are also deploying a similar politics of ambiguity. Are transitions back to civilian rule actually underway in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Guinea? Officially, yes, but the timelines have proven infinitely malleable and always in ways that advantage the ruling juntas. Of course, delaying tactics and obfuscation only works sometimes. In 2015, Nigeria's then president, Goodluck Jonathan, postponed high-stakes elections in 6 weeks in what his administration called a response to the Boko Haram crisis, which was truly raging at the time, but what many critics, including me, also read as a play for more time. Ultimately, Jonathan was decisively beaten. Even third-term bids can backfire. Just ask Niger's Mamadou Tanja or Guinea's Alpha Conde, both of whom secured third terms, only to see themselves overthrown just months later. Still, there are many zones where heads of state can benefit from ambiguity. The referendum is a favorite tactic. Does a strong yes vote for the incumbent's proposals indicate meaningful popular support, or does the yes vote rather indicate an atmosphere of intimidation and/or apathy? Another key tactic, as mentioned above, is the court case or corruption investigation targeting an opponent. Is there merit to the case, or is it a trumped-up political charge? Yet another tactic is the court ruling vis-a-vis an election. Are rulings that favor the incumbent simply representative of courts adjudicating the facts, or are the courts in the incumbent's pocket? Such ambiguity, I think, is especially beneficial to incumbents in the international arena, particularly when it comes to Africa. Washington, Paris, Brussels, etc. are slow to criticize incumbents, and even slower to criticize incumbents perceived as allies. One consequence is that incumbents can make a lot of aggressive moves before Western diplomats react to the quote-unquote crisis. In Mali's case, for example, Western diplomats appeared to ignore then-President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's problematic re-election in 2018 and the even more problematic legislative elections of 2020, when a court cushioned the presidential party's losses by reversing the outcomes of numerous races. The crisis became apparent in summer 2020 with mass protests against Keita and then a coup. But the actual crisis was not limited to those few months' events and had rather been festering for years. Similarly, the warning signs were there for years about Saul's executive overreach, but there was relatively little international pushback against his treatment of Sonko or other opponents. We could multiply examples here. Niger is another. Again, the ambiguity advantages incumbents. It is rare for one to come out and say, I'm forcing through this referendum for my own benefit, or I'm manipulating the courts to harass my opponents. These forms of plausible deniability can enable bigger and bigger forms of overreach until a country finds itself beyond a point of no return. The next section is called, Is There a Way to Decenter the Presidency? The power of the presidency distorts many countries' politics. For one thing, the skills needed to capture the presidency are quite different from the skills needed to govern. As the presidency becomes more and more powerful, the contest for presidencies rewards several archetypes. One archetype is the figure with tremendous staying power, someone who has quote-unquote paid their dues over time, either within dominant parties, Joe Biden comes to mind, or as the longtime face of the opposition. Abdoulaye Wade of Senegal and Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria are two examples. Another archetype is the charismatic figure who bursts onto the scene relatively quickly, but then secures considerable elite support. Barack Obama comes to mind. In West Africa currently, yet another archetype is the ambitious colonel or general who seizes the reins of power from an embattled civilian. Common to all these archetypes, however, is that their skills, longevity, charisma, coup-making, really have little to do with their ability to devise effective policies. Saul, for example, can boast of some GDP growth and infrastructural improvements, but some of the basic problems that have haunted Senegal for a long time, electricity supply and water security, among others, remain dire as Saul nears the end of his tenure. Another example is Nigeria's current president Bola Tinubu, almost the epitome of the country's quote-unquote godfather-style politics, a master of coalition building and hardball electoral politics, but now visibly struggling, as almost anyone would be, in fairness, to rein in a severe economic crisis, to say nothing of multiple security challenges. As I've written here before, in country after country, from the US to Nigeria, populations bemoan the lack of strong presidents, but in a way, the obsession with the presidency plays into the hands of would-be strongmen, while also vacuuming up political energies that could be deployed elsewhere. That's not an injunction to just go local and ignore the obvious weight of the presidency in many countries. Although the local is bound up with the national in many ways, obviously, notably, two of the three key challengers to Saul have been mayors, just as Saul himself was a mayor when he challenged Wade. In any case, the presidency cannot be ignored. Senegal shows just how vulnerable a country can be to incumbents' efforts at manipulating the system, and how it takes a combination of street protests and institutional independence to push back. Not every country has that. For the left, finally, there's a dilemma here. A strong state, presumably with a strong executive, is crucial to many left visions of social transformation. Yet, the strong executive can be one of the biggest barriers to such policies, or even to meaningful change at all. The maneuvering of figures like Saul can end up dominating countries for years, if not decades. And even when those maneuvers come to ruin, as with the Issoufou Bazoum transition in Niger, the aftermath is often much worse. How to discipline and then harness presidencies is one of the greatest political challenges of our time. In Senegal, battling back Saul's ambitions may yet yield one of many thin victories that consists of forcing one ambitious incumbent out, but without generating a fundamentally new chapter wherein politics becomes something more than a contest of personalities for a single office.